I was plugged in pretty early to the TTSA group and some others, and I immediately kind of saw some red flags that, you know, made my inquisitive mind start to think. And then not too long after that, I was no longer included in certain things.
There are people who bitterly resent and don't think it's a good idea that Lou be appointed to a position of power in UAP Transparency because they think that he was part of a previous agenda that was essentially to try to control the narrative.
Ross Coulthard coming out and talking about Lou Elizondo in a different light. These are interesting developments.
Yeah, well, it's not a development for you and I who've been talking about this for 4 years, 3 years. Is Ross positioning Lou as somebody who is more important than he is?
And there's been a lot of different red flags that have popped up over the years, and it gets dismissed as drama or that you're attacking someone who's on the team. And again, like you said, you made a point about the fact that this is not something new, that the disinformation agents and the people that are in the intelligence community that have come in to create noise, this is something that we know is an issue for decades, not just in the UFO subject, but any sort of meaningful, like you said, public conversation that also implicates national security or anything that they consider sensitive.
Why are they here? Where are they coming from? And what is the technology behind these devices that we're observing?
Intelligence community takes interest into groups that have power and scale. So, you know, when the UFO community, which is a pretty large community internationally and nationally, if they can co-opt that and control narrative, it's an incredible tool for them. The general public is being left behind. This is the pattern that's occurring, and this is my fear, is that big companies and the government will be using AI models that are so exponentially more capable than what the rest of us have access to, that doing anything about it will become virtually impossible. A lot of what we're seeing is research, deep black programs outside of any sort of oversight, impossible to find. Dario, who I absolutely cannot stand, he has been fear-mongering for quite some time about the inherent risks of AI.
When I was out in D.C. and in Virginia, John Warner took us around the area of D.C. where they're building these data centers. And I mean, it was really something to behold, and not in a good way.
That cathedral you're talking about with all the nubs would be like a Rosetta Stone.
I wanted to get you on because we were having a talk privately the other day, and I just happened to bring up the fact that, and this is something that I only have cursory knowledge on, which is again why I've got Mackay on to talk about it. I brought up the fact that OpenAI, Sam Altman, have got into agreements with the US government over their latest model, and it seems like there's basically going to be some form of government contract to specific people, but the general public is not going to get access to these types of programs, these types of AIs. So Mackay was saying, oh, you know, it's it's worse than that, but I want you to kind of bring people up to speed on that particular scenario and then expound on where your concerns are and what we were talking about.
Well, it kind of harkens to some of our earlier conversations several years ago where I, you know, I'll toot my own horn, where I predicted this actual outcome, unfortunately. So what's going on in the industry, and the industry meaning AI, is absolute pandemonium, especially for small businesses and entrepreneurs and working professionals. So what's happened is in the U.S., we now have three, if you count Elon Musk's XAI, but really OpenAI and Anthropic. And what they're trying to do is create a silo around their models, meaning they control the U.S. market, and they're doing so. Anthropic, for example, Dario, who I absolutely cannot stand, he has been fear-mongering for quite some time about the inherent risks of AI. Needless to say, none of them talk about the economics of AI. You know, it's more security-based. And so what he did is he drummed up all this fear, and they launched this model called Fable 5 or Mythos or whatever nomenclature they're using for their marketing. And it was very quickly, after a few days, pulled by the U.S. government for security reasons. And those security reasons were that this model was able to identify security flaws in some of the mega companies and departments of the United States. Obviously, that kind of...
So they were concerned about hacking major security databases.
Yeah, they were very concerned. But what's different is, in any other industry, it would fall back on the organizations to resolve those issues, not close down the good or service being provided. And so they kind of market it as a security thing. But in reality, what is happening is that the U.S. government and then the mega multinationals, so that's like Amazon, that's Microsoft, that's Oracle, all the big, big companies called selected partners, are now able to leverage these models that are iterations beyond what the public is able to access. And they can leverage them unrestricted and without all this fencing. And what that does is it creates an immediate barrier for them to kind of leapfrog and widen the gap, so to speak, the competitive gap that capitalism is based on. You know, capitalism works when competition is active and healthy. What they're doing is strategically moving policy and all this stuff to keep people and companies from being able to leverage this type of AI. And I can't really think of an analogy or metaphor that would work in this case, because it's pretty unique. It's pretty unique. It's like...
But it's almost like what started off as a kind of Wild West gold rush with various companies beginning their AIs has now been fenced off and monopolized by the giants, right?
Yep. And they're going to use these models to further improve their products and services, while the rest of us are using older iterations of the models that aren't as capable, and we will never be able to catch up. So it's just two trend lines, and our trend line is going up, but they're using these advanced models that will further enhance their ability to stay on top and close down free market competition. Obviously, that's a problem. But my biggest irritation, which I kind of voiced to you on our recent call, was that you have someone like Dario, the CEO and founder of Anthropic, fear-mongering open source. And for your viewers, I'm sure most know what open source is, but I'll speak to the kind of lowest common denominator. Open source is just the term used for the movement of people and projects that allow companies and other individuals to use the software, like Python or any of the tools that, when you use ChatGPT or Claude, the tools like image analysis or text-to-speech or PDF viewing, any of those things, those were all born from open source. Those are people like you and me coding in their apartments and then posting it to GitHub to allow other people to work off of it. And so that's how Anthropic and OpenAI built their companies. But now what we're seeing is this pandering toward the government, you know, saying open source is dangerous. It isn't any more dangerous than anything else. You know, you could take a stick and beat somebody's car with it. Are sticks dangerous? Yeah, I guess so. But you know.
But I suppose, I mean, at least from the particular point that they've been driving at the moment, the fact that this recent model apparently allowed for certain security breaches in national infrastructure, that I suppose open source could be a massive risk, right? If someone decided they wanted to just take down the World Bank internal database, or
Yeah, absolutely. And then so the bank.
not that I'm condoning the closing of open source,
No,
but
that's their argument. And my argument is that's the bank's problem to resolve that, like any good capital.
Create countermeasures,
Yes.
create
You know,
countermeasures.
that's called healthy capitalism. It's a very competitive marketplace, and that's what drives innovation is competitiveness. Once you start stifling competitiveness out, not only are they not foreseeing the ramifications of what stifling open source would do, it would collapse huge sections of the economy because most of the infrastructure we use today is open source. People don't realize that. Linux is open source. Linux runs on pretty much everything.
I think Grok is open source as
Yeah,
well, isn't it?
Grok
Grok AI, fully open.
yeah. So some of the like Meta releases open source models. Grok releases its or XAI releases its models open source.
So are there other, apart from people like Elon Musk, are there any other leading edge AI entrepreneurs and people who are at the top of this that are very much trying to push back from,
Yeah, they just happen to be Chinese, and therein lies the
Oh,
problem.
okay. So there's a political optics issue at play as well then,
Yeah,
essentially.
tremendous, tremendous. So that is one of the big reasons that Dario is, I'll say, shitting on open source is because he's trying to close out the competition. His biggest argument is that China is finding clever ways to steal the way Anthropic builds its models. Okay. So, yeah, I get it. But at the same time, Anthropic stole all of its training data to build its models. So it's like a thief pointing at another thief saying, he stole my stolen goods, which is, you know, ridiculous. But anyway, China is producing some really phenomenal models. We actually use a couple of the models for Coyus, and I use them myself. They're called stateless queries, meaning they don't get saved to a database. It's just like a one iteration thing. And we use that for operational stuff and small tasks. But they're really scared. They're really scared because China is doing quite a bit to stay afloat. And if the US continues on this path where it's trying to close itself off from the competitive marketplace, it's going to be bad. It's going to be bad.
I mean, it's kind of comparable to the black technology classified world, reverse engineering world. And do you want to put this into a classified silo with a few experts who will slowly get there, but it's going to take more time because they can't, cross-pollinate ideas and go into the international marketplace of ideas? Or do you want to open source it? And that way, I would imagine actually you'd get exponential improvement because you've just got such a large palette of individuals contributing. So in China's case, they are likely going to be doing a lot better than America. But America, I mean, at the end of the day, this is the AI arms race, right? This is the next big thing. So if you want to be at the top of the game, I would imagine open source truly is the way to go. You get so much more innovation.
Not only do you get better PR, you get more innovation based. So, you know, for example, Meta or NVIDIA releasing their models open source, contributors have already improved those models. And they what they do is they, you know, modify the weights and biases. They find ways to shrink it down and speed it up and make it more efficient. And so as a company, whoever released that open source model would then go review what the open source community did with it, find anything useful that you could bring to your next iteration. And that is how open source is beneficial to innovation. But, you know, Anthropic is they really went from, they really screwed their their image considerably. The open source community is at arms over Anthropic, and they're, you know, I don't know what they plan on doing with their trajectory, but it doesn't seem very good.
I saw recently that, just to kind of slightly switch lanes, but I saw recently that Richard Dawkins, isn't it, the chief atheist, one of the top atheists. Yeah, Richard Dawkins recently said that he believes Claude or cloud AI is conscious, which I thought was a very interesting comment from someone like him. Almost contradictory.
And that's not, and we've gone into great depths of this particular
subject. Yeah, it fascinates me.
I don't think it's conscious now, but that doesn't mean its current iteration isn't capable of becoming consciousness. So what happens when you or I use a chat is that it's a single instance of that chat. So once you delete that chat, that model, that is dead. That kind of iteration is dead. It doesn't continue on. If we wanted to make a model conscious, we would have unlimited server capacity, unlimited data capacity, and let it run and let it loop and self-reflect and self-evolve over time. It could become...
Do you think there's like maybe people out there trying to do that? These data centers are getting incredible.
I don't think that. I know that that's occurring.
Everyone's trying to drive towards the singularity, right?
I know it's occurring in the private sector. You know, they are interested in that. And I would suspect that that's happening at a federal capacity, particularly maybe Department of Energy or DOD or it's Department of War now, you know, especially with having access, direct access to unrestricted versions of GPT 5.6 or Fable 5, and they can run, you know, without budgetary concerns, you know, on their hardware. You have to think that that's kind of what they're doing, or at least of interest. Other than that, they're just gamifying political and military strategy well beyond what current models can perform.
I saw on X not even that long ago, and I was watching it for a little while, just thinking, God, this is actually pretty weird. There was a live stream of a robot doing packing for a factory on an assembly line, you know, just sorting through parcels on a live stream. And it seems like it's becoming a lot more manifested and real.
The robotic hardware, that's the physical framework of the mechanical body, has been available for a long time. The newest additions are the sensor packages, meaning tactile or audio visual.
Right.
And then also the connections to a model, an LLM, or a multimodal model that can see vision and produce, you know, whatever. And so that is becoming integrated now, and they're working on improving that. I honestly think within a few years, we'll start to see high priced robotic platforms. And that's how these things start. You sell very expensive platforms first, and then you drive prices down over time. And you do that through efficiently manufacturing, you know, getting more cost effective ways to do things. And so I think within 3 years, we'll see more of the high end robotic models. So maybe luxury or geared toward wealthy individuals. So like you could see somebody in a mansion might have one for $100,000 or something. And then subsequently 3 to 5 years later, it will fall down enough for public, you know, use. And I fully agree with Elon's assessment that eventually robots will be the highest, the most prominent industry on Earth. I fully believe that it's going to take some time. Mm-hmm. We don't have the infrastructure right now. We don't have available Wi-Fi everywhere for robotics to move about. We don't have affordable batteries just yet that a robot, you know, won't have to recharge every couple hours. But those things are just hurdles. They're not stopgaps.
I'm looking forward to having my own personal little drone with some AI intelligence, you know, to take out these megalithic sites, and it can talk to me and I can send off.
That would be cool.
Yeah, like, you know, a little pocket drone that you can just send down a tunnel with a flashlight and it will record for me and relay back some information. I'm all for that. 100% for that. And I agree with you. I think it's very much around the corner now. You know, we're getting to this very interesting point. It does feel like we could be approaching this Dynacorp type of, you know, monopoly.
Oh, yeah.
And that concerns me. Again, the innovation doesn't concern me so much as who's innovating.
Not who's innovating, who's controlling, you know.
Who's controlling the flow and the channel of that innovation.
Yeah, so right now, these big AI companies, they scrape our data. Everything that's from you and me, they get from how we interact with them, but they also procure it from data brokers, from, you know, all sorts of areas. We don't get anything from it. So they're basically taking open source technology, stealing our data, you know, getting tax grants from the government.
Yeah, we should at least get paid.
So we're paying for all of this. We're giving them our data, and then they turn around and charge us a premium to utilize it while they're building data centers in our towns that utilize our infrastructure.
My God.
It's parasitic. Yeah, it's absolutely parasitic. Except a parasite doesn't then force the host to give it more to keep the parasite there feeding on the host. It's even worse. It is dystopian. And it's kind of what I feared all along. I was hoping, and it didn't seem like it was going to happen. Well,
let's talk about the AI data centers. When I was out in DC and Virginia, John Warner took us around the area of DC where they're building these data centers. And I mean, it was really something to behold, and not in a good way. It was just a shocking amount of infrastructure and cranes still constructing buildings. More buildings than you could even see, all nameless, with all of these huge cables coming out of it, all AI data centers.
Look at it. It's all these. Look at this. It's like a city.
This whole place is data centers.
It's nothing but electrical power generation.
Yeah.
In the daytime, I'll send you pictures. It's insane. They have their own grids, man. Their own electrical grids.
Yep, and that's true. It's independent.
Some Nightwing's part of right there.
RTX.
RTX is Raytheon.
And I've seen a lot of reports from America of these small towns where their electricity is being diverted to these data centers, let alone the amplitude of excess electromagnetic energy and thermal heat that's coming off of these things. So, like, what do you think the end game is here? Because it seems like there's no sign of slowing down, but there's only so much space on this planet. At some point, it feels like you need to unfurl this endeavor into space.
That is probably the end goal, but that's a long way away. We still haven't made launching things into space affordable. So they're going to keep building it on Earth.
Yeah, and we still have so much natural land, which can be replaced with concrete buildings.
Yeah.
Let's forget space.
Yeah. I see, you know, I could see in the before space data centers having undersea data centers where they can pump cold seawater. But that poses its own problems. You have millions and millions of hecta acres of data servers, server stations producing heat where it's traditionally cold. And that could very quickly screw up some of the oceanic currents. But again, that's probably more long term. They're fine building.
I wonder if they've got anything down in Antarctica.
Yeah.
That'd be the place to do it.
Antarctica, that's an interesting continent. Completely militarized. Completely. And they try to keep public a way saying, you know, they're trying to preserve it, but everybody knows that's bullshit.
If there was going to be some super cooled quantum AI computer, it would probably be a few meters down into the ice in Antarctica in some weird classified base. That wouldn't shock me at all.
Wouldn't surprise me at all. So, yeah, data centers, yeah. I was going to say, they're not great. I liken them to the natural gas. In the United States, there was a movement for natural gas production and collection. And we saw time and time again, these natural gas facilities come in, they wreak havoc on the public water table and infrastructure. The government does absolutely nothing. I mean, I'm sure there's still towns that with undrinkable water that there were no ramifications. And I see data centers very similar to that. They come in, they drain all the energy, they utilize a lot of water. And so what happens is energy is like anything else. It's supply and demand. Now that the demand is so high because the data centers are using a lot of it, the supply gets reduced and the cost goes up for the average consumer. So again, we're footing the bill again.
Well, this is something I've seen a lot of people complaining about recently. Literally like a week ago, I think someone made a post on X saying, if now's the time that you're trying to buy a Mac, it's a really bad time to be trying to buy anything because all of the hardware has gone up in price because of the necessity to provide to these data centers.
That's a really great point, Jay. And that's also another angle that they are attacking open source. And it seems you wouldn't make the connection naturally, but if you kind of step back and think about it, is they're eating up all of the consumer grade hardware that people like me and small businesses need to build local AI workstations or servers. So for example, if we wanted to expand our servers for Coyus, we would have to buy certain types of processing cards, video processing cards. Those cards now are multitudes more expensive than they used to be. The RAM is many times what it was a couple years ago for the same, you know, the same type of RAM because these data centers have sucked up the entire hardware market. In fact, NVIDIA has completely pivoted away from consumers to only focus on big, enterprise data centers. Wow. So they mostly now sell to data centers. The company was built by consumer marketing.
Yeah.
You know, it was.
But that's the thing. They're all just going to follow where the wind's blowing. Yeah. And,
you know, it's a good business strategy, but it screws
right.
the rest
screws
of us.
Over yeah. everyone that's built your company up. And yeah, no, that's a major problem. And it's not sustainable. Like, that's the thing, is this isn't sustainable. So at some point, this has to actually come. It feels like this is a period of like elite banditry within this particular arena. And at some point, it has to kind of come crashing down. Policy has to be formed.
Yeah, policy does need to be formed, but more so to protect, you know, public access and small business access. But that's not what will happen. We know at this point, policy is almost never designed for public benefit, which is counterintuitive because that's why we have a Senate here in the States. But they time and time again side with big enterprise and government security minded strategies. So again, you know, the general public is being left behind. This is the pattern that's occurring, and this is my fear, is that big companies and the government will be using AI models that are so exponentially more capable than what the rest of us have access to that doing anything about it will become virtually impossible.
So as someone who really understands the AI landscape, what would you say right now are the major differences between these closed off private models that the companies are leveraging and perhaps allowing governments to use, and in comparison to what we have access to? Like, what kind of features, what kind of availability do they have that we don't?
It's not so much features, it's the ability for the models to understand and infer and think and code substantially better than open source models. A Chinese company produced a model called GLM 5.2, and that does really well. It's probably on par with Opus 4.8, maybe a little bit less, and it's cost effective to run, and it does all of the same things. So, kind of to get down and dirty into the technical level, a model in and of itself is just a chatbot. A model becomes an agent when it's surrounded by a harness. A harness is all of the prompts and instructions and tools and hooks surrounding the model to give it agency, to give it the ability to think and act and have memory and use tools and to do things. So a foundation model, like if you go to Claude.com or GPT.com, you're using their model with their proprietary harness on it. That harness was built out of open source tools, by the way. But that model itself is better at thinking and reasoning than what's available to the open source community. And what's going to happen is their models are going to get better and better and better, while it's going to be harder for the open source community to have access to anything better and better and better. In fact, my fear is that we're closing in on what will ever be as good for the open source community. So
almost like this right now is the golden moment of open AI, and that might close very soon.
I'm sure there'll be a few more models over the time that might be a little bit better, but we're losing ground in what we have access to. So I would recommend any of your tech savvy viewers is download all the open source models you can now, save them on an external hard drive, and just hold on to them, because it may come to a point where those are no longer available for your use.
It really feels like if they could have found a way to never let the general population of humanity know about AI, they just wouldn't have, right?
It's hard to frame our governments and mega companies as so cynical, but it's the pattern. You know, if it's the
right,
if it fits, you know, that's what it is. And you're right. You know, they would love nothing more than to leverage these models and have all of us clueless. That they would love nothing mm-hmm. more than that. But they can't.
The best thing to do for people who are interested is to download these AIs and, you know, build your own, keep it on your desktop, save them.
And you can use LM Studio or Ollama, and they're very easy to set up. They have a user interface. You just download it to your laptop or computer, and then you can download the models. And once you've downloaded them, they're on your computer forever. No policy, no government can steal them from you once you have them. And so what I do is, you know, for my company workstation, is I'll download the best model all the time, even if I don't use it often or can't use it at the moment because our rack of processing is not big enough to run some of these models. Some are, you know, a terabyte in size, but having them for the future or just retaining them is important.
I'm sorry if you're occasionally hearing an asshole teenager on a motorbike. That's our neighborhood douchebag. He likes to come flying down this side of the road.
We have those here.
I think everyone has a neighborhood douchebag. You know what I mean? But no, I mean, you know, this is a very strange time, like feeling again like we're on this delicate balance between the old world and the new world. And the new world is extremely uncertain. And it's not just the fact that AI is being leveraged in the, you know, commercial space and the economic space, but also it's being weaponized. It's being used in the defense sector. A lot of these companies are also getting linked up to the Pentagon and what they like to call full spectrum dominance. You know, this idea of complete spectrum dominance on every single type of theater of war.
That's what they want, Jay. That's what they're working toward. And it's always going to be a battle between nation states and their AI funded departments and their programs, you know, because are eventually the U.S. AGI that runs our military will be combating, not physically, but combating with how another nation state's AI is thinking and planning. So it's like a game of chess that we just initiated in the world, where every, you know, top tier nation wants their AI to outperform the other nation's AI.
And who's actually ahead? Is China ahead or is America ahead?
No, America's ahead at the moment. China's ahead in efficiency, meaning they're paying a lot less because they're... So let me kind of backtrack and explain why Anthropic is super pissed at China. China ended up creating, I think, and correct me in the comments if I'm wrong, but I think it was like 20,000 accounts that they created. And what they did was they systematically asked Claude or Fable questions, and they take those questions and answers and feed them back to the Chinese database. And they what they ended up doing, and mind you, China paid for all of this. So they didn't, Anthropic made a lot of money from these accounts. So they were fine when they were getting paid. Like, as a business owner, I'm very well aware of, you know, where my customers are from and how much data and how much money is. So they knew, you know, China was paying all this money. So like that in and of itself is a red flag to me. Anyway, so China got all of this data back from how the model was responding to specific questions, and then went ahead and trained a new AI model on those, on that training data. And so they did it for a fraction of the cost. Yes, it's a little underperforming where we are, but they're spending 10x less, maybe 100x less than what we're spending. So I could see a future where China leapfrogs us. All you need in a competitive market is one significant innovation to leapfrog another. And so that's all that's needed. But right now, U.S. is leading in the AI arms race, so to speak.
You want to talk about UFOs a little bit?
Yeah. I can't come on your show and not talk about UFOs.
Ross Coulthard coming out and talking about Lou Elizondo in a different light. These are interesting developments.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's not a development for you and I, who have been talking about this for 4 years, 3 years. I don't even know how long it's been.
I'd say a decent portion of my audience probably feel the same.
Yeah.
But...
yeah, well,
it's taken a while for the rest to catch up.
We received some heat, especially, you know, I got ostracized by my network. I was plugged in pretty early to the TTSA group and some others, and I immediately kind of saw some red flags that, you know, made my inquisitive mind start to think. And then not too long after that, I was no longer included in certain things. And, you know, it was pretty obvious for those of us who kind of stepped back and took a critical look at this whole thing. So it is a big event that someone like Ross made such a comment. But I'm wondering, you know, is Ross positioning Lou as somebody who is more important than he is?
Yeah, I would say yes. That was one of the things that I took issue with, was the invoking of this legacy program history that he apparently has, and I really don't buy that still.
Yeah, I have my doubts as well. I don't doubt the disinformation angle. I mean, it's pretty effing obvious. Like, you go back really early on, he literally says, you know, he is a
he said I'm a counterintelligence, counterterrorism, and I brought that skill set to the UFO community.
And this isn't new. This is very par for the course. Like, the counterintelligence happens at all levels, nationally and internationally, and in organizations all over the place. The intelligence community takes interest into groups that have power and scale. So, you know, when the UFO community, which is a pretty large community internationally and nationally, if they can co-opt that and control narrative, it's an incredible tool for them to disinform, to mitigate truth.
Which I would say that they successfully achieved for a number of years and perhaps still are achieving.
I think they still are. And I'm wondering, you know, I I'm sorry, Ross, I know, you know, Ross and I have spoke before, but I'm starting to question Ross as well. Like, how did Ross not know this? And as a good moral kind of standing and journalism, if he had these sentiments earlier on, he should have brought them up.
It's like I did say in the video I did recently, that Ross told me on the phone and a number of years, about, you know, 3 years ago, that Lou had said to him that the ATIP program was a cutout. It was a fabrication that had been made in preparation for the To the Stars Academy rollout to give something to the New York Times. And so, you know, I know that he was at least harboring some level of doubt about Lou, but was refraining from, you know, speaking about this publicly, which I think, as you know, led to me, amongst other factors, distancing myself from this element of the UFO subject. And I do feel like we're being vindicated to a certain degree, because a lot of people are now seeing the issues specifically with Lou. But it has taken a while, and there's been a lot of different red flags that have popped up over the years, and it gets dismissed as drama, or that you're attacking someone who's on the team. And again, like you said, you made a point about the fact that this is not something new, that the disinformation agents and the people that are in the intelligence community that have come in to create noise, this is something that we know is an issue for decades, not just in the UFO subject, but any sort of meaningful, like you said, public conversation that also implicates national security or anything that they consider sensitive, they'll put their people into it. And so we know that happens. When you start seeing like one sign after another, that there's a particular person that seems to be doing exactly that, it's very strange to me how long it's taken for people to get to a point where they're willing to say this. And I mean, I know for my own experience that you will absolutely invoke the hate of a lot of people online, and some people can't deal with the online harassment and have been scared away from speaking. But it has certainly taken a long time for the UFO community to, I would say, on the majority side, come around on this and go, actually, you know what, this guy is pretty questionable.
Yeah, and it's hard for me to believe, and Ross, if you watch this, please correct me, and I'll be happy to you know, revoke my belief, but it's hard for me to believe that a seasoned journalist, investigative journalist, did not see these patterns 2 to 3 years ago. I just don't buy it. And so that leads me down a path of analysis that he did know and didn't do anything about it, or he's setting something else up. I don't know. Why come out now? You know, what's going on? I would love to hear his take. I would love to hear why he thinks that, and how long he knew, and what does he think is actually going on?
I mean, I'd love to get him back on if he'd want to talk.
It's I hope I didn't ruin it with my
Well, no, I'm sure you didn't. I might have ruined it with my own criticisms of late. But you know, me and Ross have been friends for a number of years, and he was, you know, the first one to come onto my platform when he was talking about UFOs. It was on my channel, so I know that he's invested in this subject, and I've had a communication with him over the years that's made me think this guy legitimately does want to get to the bottom of this. But I have to also agree with you when it feels like sometimes I think there's a level of...
See, there you go. You can hear him, right?
Can you hear that, or can you not hear that?
I can hear it a little bit. It's not as bad as you think.
Okay, well, that's good. But I think that there's a level of self-preservation of reputation that takes place in this subject, where people would rather position themselves with the popular talking point. And right now, the popular talking point is moving away from being pro-Lu. So there could be a reason in that he's seeing that this is the natural consensus of the UFO community. And maybe it's time to be a little bit more honest about how he's felt for a couple of years. But again, these are all assumptions, because we need to hear more about it from Ross himself.
I see it as in... in counterintelligence, if one of your assets is flagged or it becomes optical, you need to migrate assets. You need a new baton holder. And I'm anxious that this is just setting up for a new baton holder. Lou's kind of been fading out for some time, mm-hmm. and some people came in to fill that gap, but those people are from the same exact circle. So come on, people, use some critical thinking.
Well, I use an example in our own political sphere in the UK right now, because a lot of people are so happy that Keir Starmer has decided to resign as prime minister. It feels like a victory on the surface level, but there's not going to be a general election. So it's going to be a re-election from within his party. So they are going to put someone in who's just the exact same person in a different face. And so I would use that as the example. It's like resetting the aggro, right? You've reset all of the mass anger about this particular individual. And now you've brought someone in who's going to act on the same behalf. I mean, it's kind of like seeing people getting positioned for levels of authority in the UFO community in respects like the government task forces, like Professor Avi Loeb. I interviewed this guy. He doesn't really seem to know anything, and he seems to be very closed off to the idea that any sort of conspiracies are real, and he doesn't have a deep level of research knowledge on the classified work that's been done for decades on this subject or any of the particular areas that we consider to be vitally important for disclosure. And so it seems like they're just putting faces and talking heads up as these guys that are going to be on these task forces, who will probably, I would imagine, get run around in circles by the intel guys who are going to feed them information, and it'll just drip, drip, drip out over time, and it'll be very curated, and it won't really get anywhere. That's my thought.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
It's very pessimistic, but it's because it's at this point, it's hard not to be, right?
I think we kind of are moving toward cynicism, really. I mean, but it's hard to, when it's a repeating pattern over and over and over again. You become habitualized to just think it's BS, and that's an effective tool in counterintelligence. And you know what else is an effective tool? If you ever, and your viewers can kind of keep this in the back of your mind when you hear these prominent UFO speakers present, if you find people that sound like they're speaking from a script, so meaning every time you hear them, it's just a reframing of the same thing, that should be a red flag for you.
I want to ask real quick, because I've had experiences, and I've said this before, that if I didn't have those experiences, based on what I've seen from the conversation so far, I probably would stop believing UFOs exist to a certain degree. So I kind of want to check your temperature on that. What do you actually think is real and what's not real in this subject?
Yeah, I think I would be on the side of not believing had I not had the deep understanding of ancient history. Like you, it's a topic that fascinates me. And I think our first interview, I think it was our first interview.
It was one of them. I was about to say, for anyone who doesn't know, I'll put a link in the comments section of the video for a chronological timeline breakdown of paranormal/UFO events that Mackay did. It was definitely one of the very first interview/presentations that you did on my channel. And I want to say it's about an hour and a half, coming up on 2 hours of just this really good deep dive way back into the prehistoric BC times. Fantastic. So everyone check that out after this.
Yeah, so if it weren't for his historical accounts, so pre-modern times, I probably wouldn't believe it. And so that's probably why a majority of people don't believe it now, is because they don't have the breadth of knowledge regarding history. And that really helps. I do think that a lot of what we're seeing is research, deep, deep, deep black programs outside of any sort of oversight, impossible to find.
Yep.
I think a lot of that is that. We're talking Department of Energy and Lockheed and Boeing and Raytheon. I think they are all kind of working on these things, and they're able to silo this stuff it's invisible. There's no way to FOIA it. There's no way for a senator to find it.
That's also why I kind of take exception to this. It seems to be a bit more of a recent trend. I think it is since the Age of Disclosure documentary came out, just calling this the program, like the legacy program, like it's this one singular entity, when we know that it's very likely spread across a whole umbrella of different programs that aren't related in any way that you would understand. And then, you know, you connect them all together and it builds something incredible. But if everyone in these programs won't know what the actual macro structure is. So this idea that they're looking for the legacy program just seems extremely reductive and not realistic.
Well, that's the point. You can look all day for a monolithic legacy program and not find anything. I think it's intended by design. You know, they can say they're looking for it, but they'll never find it because it's a highly compartmentalized octopus where no one knows everything, and the connections are vague and ambiguous on purpose. It was designed that way. You work on a project like this over 50 years, you figure out ways to fund it. You figure out ways to transfer to partners. You figure out ways to control information and disinformation. And so it's completely broken apart. And I don't think it's just the US either. I think that's a big mistake that we focus on. I think there are countries like Argentina, Italy, Germany, the UK, Australia, probably Israel, Russia. I don't know how much China is involved, but I'm sure they have a you know, an idea of what's going on. So I think it's a multinational enterprise, if you want.
Well, I mean, that is one of the law narratives that people invoke, is that there is this transnational element that supersedes nation states and the petty squabbles of presidents between countries, and that there are silent agreements on incredibly disruptive technology because they all recognize that it can't, you know, go out until the right time, or, you know, whatever. And, you know, I can see that. And it does seem like at some point in the early 1940s, 50s period, this broke away from any sort of official entity like the CIA and the Air Force, and it did go into the private entities. This is where it broke away in the Cold War. The iron wall of secrecy comes down, and we start seeing, you know, various elements of the scientific avenues being explored in the 1950s in physics suddenly disappear. And I think there's a clear chronology to showcase that this did go into the black world around the 50s, 60s period. And, you know, the idea that nothing's been developed since then, I would consider as completely nonsensical. I do think that one of the elements of this narrative that's coming through in the UFO discussion via government is to create this perception of like, oh no, we do agree with you now that UFOs exist. There's just absolutely no doubt. We've got all these videos and there's pilots, but we don't know what they are. We have no idea. Let's start investigating it. You know what I mean? It feels like they're trying to step up and start from this position, which completely disregards all of this research and development history generationally.
Yeah. No, it would be very easy for certain people in government to investigate this. And all you do, this is as simple as it gets, is you find out who's denying access to something. And that's where you start.
Right.
That's where you start. You put them in custody and you force them to comply.
Well, you know, head to the Special Access Program Oversight Committee. Start shaking some shoulders, you know.
100%. If you're being denied something and you are technically, so say you're like the defense secretary, or you're one of the generals on, you know, the Security Council or whatever. If you are that high and you're being denied access to stuff, arrest that person. Start there. You know, at that point, you are basically saying, you know, without saying, we have stuff and we're doing things that we don't want to tell you, and tough shit to you. And we're gonna use these very vague military and security, you know, policies to try to keep you from following. But nobody ever focuses on the people who are the roadblockers. Never hear those names ever. You never hear, you hear Congress people saying, oh, we tried to get XYZ. Tim Burchett has tried this a million times. But Tim has never said who is telling him.
Exactly. You're never hearing, you know, it was Ted Baker's of the DOE. He was the one that denied me access or something like that. You know, they're not putting out these types of names. Like, you don't hear that.
You don't hear that. You don't hear that. And I suspect that is for fear. Rather than,
I mean, this might be discussed in the SCIF environment that we're not partial to understanding or being, you know, allowed to know about.
I don't even think so. I really don't think so. Somehow these people are able to just judo their way out of it, jujitsu their way out of it.
Well, it's like time. This is the story behind the Admiral Wilson documents. You remember the Admiral Wilson documents? You know,
Oak Shannon.
And, you know, I'm still not 100% sure how I feel about them just because of the fact that it comes through the pipeline of people like Eric Davis and Puthoff. And, you know, this is the same group of people that are doing the TTSA and the issues that we see in the modern conversation. So there's definitely something to be said there, but it is a very interesting document. And the fact that Oak Shannon, of course, confirmed that there were these elements in the document that he could confirm is true, that he was phoned by Admiral Wilson and he was asked about Eric Davis, whether or not Eric Davis was a trustworthy person to speak to. So, you know, this is the story that we see outlined in that particular scenario with the Admiral, where he was denied access. He went to the DOD. He was the, he was one of the directors of the Defense Intelligence Agency, so an incredibly high-ranking Admiral. And at least according to that script, he was denied full access. They gave him like this kind of preliminary meeting with a lawyer, a security manager, and some program director, and they basically just said that's as far as you're getting. And if it is true, he then went to the Special Access Program Oversight Committee. He went to SAPOC. He tried to raise it, and they basically said that if you keep pulling on this thread, you're going to be you're going to face an early resignation. You're going to have a couple of stars knocked off your shoulder. Shut the fuck up, you know. So if that's true, then we are dealing with, like Stephen Greer has been highlighting, to be fair to him, for, you know, many, many years, a completely anti-congressional, breakaway, non-governmental, superseding all sorts of nation laws. It's not legal in any sense of the word.
And so that's concerning to me, that type of rhetoric, like what is proclaimed, that he was threatened to have stars removed and forced into retirement or even harsh penalties. But no other situation could a ranking general of that caliber be demoted or anything like that, unless it was a higher authority. And at that level, there aren't many people higher than what he was. So we're talking maybe three people, including a president. Yeah. So again, who the hell are these people?
Yeah.
And
well, again, if it is accurate, on the bigot list was basically zero governmental, congressional, Senate staffers, defense staffers. It was all corporate entities. It was all private industry.
How could a corporate,
you know,
how could Lockheed threaten a general with losing stars? I don't understand.
Scary.
Yeah, something is not right. Something doesn't add up.
Well, it does feel like this conversation has devolved into a level of political theater. And one of the reasons why it feels that way to me is J.D. Vance recently saying, when he was asked about UFOs, he was like, oh, no, I'm very interested. We got to get to the bottom of it. I just haven't had time. It's just like, oh, he hasn't had time. That's how seriously they're taking it in the actual upper echelons.
They're too busy scrubbing the Epstein files.
Yeah, too busy scrubbing Epstein files and trying to get out of Iran. And there's a lot of things happening in the larger geopolitical space that I think is dwarfing UFOs. And I don't think people in the UFO community really understand that. And again, something I mentioned recently is this optics management. So like when me and John and John and John, J. John, John and John were out in D.C., you know, we went to the press conference event that was being done with David Grush and Luna and Burchett and Burleson. And again, there was a very small crowd of people. It was like 45, 50 people. That's including the staff that had to be there. So really, you know, maybe like 30, 35 people that had actually gone to see this thing happen. And then it gets spun up online by people like James Fox, where he's like, oh, there's an unprecedented turnout of this historic event. And it's just like, you know, it feels very theatrical, like they're just trying to convince people something's happening that's a lot bigger than it actually is. And then when you have people like the vice president going, yeah, I'll look into it when I got time, like, well, fuck it, you know, it's just kind of like, there's a balance issue with how serious it's being taken by the actual top of the Trump administration versus the congressional and the Senate stuff, you know.
Yeah, we can't lean on any sort of government disclosure. And I think that is the mistake of the community to even desire that. It will never happen. Two, if it did happen, it wouldn't be the real story. So the disclosure has occurred in terms of public awareness,
yeah,
and enough historical, you know, and again, I go back to just learn history, learn right. history before the United States, this stuff was occurring. Yeah,
for sure. So right.
It's not just, you know, some legacy program.
Yeah.
This is far back.
Well, this is what fascinates me. And again, this is why to me, it's not necessarily a departure from the UFO subject to start looking into the ancient history world, because the more you look into it, the more you see things that correlate so much with the modern day sightings and the explanations that we have in the modern era. It's just that it's being looked at through the lens of, you know, an ancient mind and an archaic perception of reality. So, you know, this to me is actually such an important element of understanding what we might be dealing with now, is to look at what our most ancient ancestors were saying about it, you know. And a lot of the time it just seems like it's more spiritual or interdimensional, however we want to perceive that.
I don't know. I really don't know. From my own brain, I find it much easier to think of it as a, you know, of our universe, they just kind of figured out galactic travel. So, you know, anti-gravitic propulsion or warping. That for me is much more digestible than I have a hard time constructing a postulation when it starts to enter the realm of multidimensionality. I'm not saying it might not be, but I can't.
I think for me, I feel forced to invoke it because of the nature of my experiences, which were ultimately rooted in me being a conscious participant and requesting and having these things appear, which, you know, seemingly would be in response to these requests, especially since it happened multiple times on different evenings. I have a hard time understanding how they could be involved in space and time in the same way as we are. Like, what, are they just hanging around waiting for a conscious phone call? Like, it feels a bit more like this is something beyond our little encapsulated arena of space and time. But whatever that truly means, I don't know, obviously. It just feels like it can't be just aliens and spaceships for these particular types of scenarios, you know?
Well, you know, advanced technology is magic. Maybe. You know,
yep, exactly. It always is. They just Arthur C. Clarke to me. I'm just an ignorant little monkey man. I had no idea.
You know, it's fun to think about. There is something. Will we ever know whether it's spiritual in nature or consciousness entwined? What I do appreciate is in recent decades is that we've become more and more accepting, and the scientific community has as well, of accepting that perhaps we don't fully understand how the universe functions at a conscious level. And we used to dismiss consciousness as pure physical and biochemical reactions and so forth. But when you start to get into the physics of the universe, you start to understand that consciousness is intertwined with reality. And I was just kind of talking to my wife recently, who's a very intelligent person and woman. And she was kind of asking me, she learned about, or I wouldn't say she just learned, but something just clicked for her about the speed of light. And I was explaining to her that even though you're standing 5 feet away from me, I'm not perceiving your consciousness as real time. It does take time for the photons of you to reach my eyes and process. And that delay is not real time. So my perception of you as my wife exists in an alternate time than your thinking mind. And so,
and that's why I don't have to do the washing up tonight, my dear.
Right. No, I'm kind of old fashioned. I like to help around the house when I can.
I know you are. Every time I call you, you're washing up something doing something in the kitchen.
We both work hard, and there are certain tasks that I don't do that I don't want to do, like laundry, and she happily does that because I cut the lawn or I do X, Y, Z.
It's a symbiotic relationship. That's a good healthy dynamic going on there. But you know, with the one of the things that does annoy me on the skeptic side of like, oh, there's no way that aliens could have visited us, is that they do invoke that kind of traditional propulsion issue, like, oh, everything's drifting so far away and there's just no physical way that they'd be able to get to us and, you know, soon enough time. I don't even understand why that's still being invoked when we can think about punching a hole through, you know, Einstein-Rosenbridge traversable wormholes. And it's crazy.
I think it's weird when people get stuck on our level of propulsion versus what physics tells us
is possible.
Is possible
given enough energy and time and material
and material science. And so even though we can prove that these are possible, we just assume that our current level of development is all that there can be. Is a non-starter for a critical thinking person. But you see that argument posed all the time.
But like you said, we are on the boundary level now within modern science, where it's starting to bleed over into the esoteric in terms of what they're discovering and how do we rationalize this and how do we explain the spooky action at a distance and these strange behaviors of the fundamental substrate of reality. Like, this is something that I find fascinating because to me, it's like a discussion between intuition and logic, right? So intuition kind of figured this out thousands and thousands of years ago. The shamans went into these different states of perception and they came back with knowledge. They came back with insight about the raw fundamental path of nature and human collective existence. And we have these messages that have been echoed through time, but they didn't come back with an artifact because you can't bring anything physical back from the intuitive realm. And so you have logic catching up, I would say, thousands of years later, digging through the bedrock, chiseling through the atoms and the protons, and eventually getting down to this sensitive little part of the world where we go, whoa, hang on a second. It's actually really similar to what that shaman said 10,000 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would like to see more acoustical engine. I don't know what the actual the actual professional title is, but an acoustics engineer or an acoustics scientist. I would like to see more research done on some of the locations that you've brought forth. That science is not out there. People have postulated due to how it resembles and reacts with sound, but no one has really done the deep dive. And
not hardcore. And there is the technical terms are archaeoacoustics, so acoustics that's invoked through architecture, and then psychoacoustic architecture, which is the idea that these acoustically engineered architectures have the ability to influence your psychology through bombardment of particular frequencies. So archaeoacoustics and psychoacoustic architecture are the kind of, I think they're mainly alt terms in the history world. These aren't really things that you would find invoked.
Yeah, I think they're derivatives of, you know, an acoustic physicist.
Certainly has a real legitimacy to it. You know, there is a pattern here with these megalithic structures and these prehistoric temples in terms of the bandwidth, which primarily sits around the 110 hertz range, which has absolute effects on the human brain.
I know. I would love to see somebody take a really, really expensive speaker and place it in certain areas of these locations and play through the spectrum and see what happened.
It's just difficult because you can't get into these a scientific team, but you know, the average Joe would be told to go away by the guard or the whatever.
I know, which is odd,
I'll tell you one thing in Egypt that they really hate and they will not let you do it is meditating and humming in the sacred spaces.
You can't hum.
Oh, no. If you start going, they'll come around the corner and go, no meditation. And they're like really strict about that in the pyramid, in the various temples.
I mean, that's telling in and of itself.
Don't make these noises here, you foreigner. You don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah. Like,
it's very interesting.
It's interesting that they've been told to disallow that.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. I'm sure they have no idea why. No. They've just been told not to let it happen.
No.
But
I know.
Yeah. And some of the spaces in the, you know, again, in the Egyptian temples, it's not just the megalithic sites in prehistory, but some of the temples in Egypt have an incredible resonance to them. You know, out in Saqqara, these underground subterranean chambers, there's a real, and this was carried on into medieval, I mean, the apex is the cathedrals, right?
Yeah.
That is kind of like the golden apex of this knowledge. And then it very much kind of got washed away. I guess it was too mixed up with theology and the science didn't catch up or something. But
I would say the Greeks and Romans borrowed from Mesopotamia at some of that acoustical engineering. I mean, they built coliseums and stadiums not on accident to amplify sound.
Yeah,
and that's
with
a
limestone.
Primitive, yeah, that's a and the way it was tiered and the way that it was cascaded upwards at a certain angle. All of that was calculated, and that knowledge came from somewhere. And that's a kind of a primitive aspect compared to some of these more ancient sites that do even more with sound.
Yeah.
And I think you're onto something. Sound is powerful. Vibrational energy is energy, flat out. That's all energy is, people. It is vibration.
Exactly.
At scale.
Well, it's like Tesla said, right? Energy, frequency, vibration. These are the things that you need to look at.
It's all the same. Everything is vibrating.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is rotational. Everything is rotating and vibrating.
And it's like when you look at the cymatic patterns that get created, you know, these incredible geometries that represent the signatures of each sound. I think like there's a lot of people who see these things and there's something deep in your intuition that just says, yeah, this is very important. This fundamental geometry that seems to be formed through sound. And then obviously when you go into these altered states of consciousness, it's so common to have these geometries come out of the woodwork in a visual format. And it definitely seems to speak to something at the absolute baseline of reality that is beautiful, a complex mosaic. Again, like as the spiritual teachings would say through all of the different thousands of years, is that there is this beautiful complex fabric of life, right? This complex mosaic. Well, you can visualize it, you can see it. And even in physics, right? Even in physics, we distill the mathematics down into these incredible geometries. It seems to be something really resonant at the baseline of reality.
Well, yeah, I mean, you take a heroic dose of a hallucinogenic, which I may or may not have done in my youth many decades ago.
Who knows?
But you see these incredible fractal geometries that I can't fathom like now. And so why and where does that derive, and why are you observing it? Why does your brain manifest that? Well, I think it has to do with the fractal and vibratory nature of reality.
I mentioned this recently, because when you get a camera and you create, you change it so that the output is the input, so it's viewing itself, and you get this recursive feedback loop, right? And I just kind of get the feeling that inward meditation, this kind of inward perception, is itself a type of recursive feedback loop where you're viewing yourself. And when you do this, again, whether it's through psychedelics or through transcendental meditation, you end up experiencing very much what that camera is showing it's experiencing through these geometries. But the difference maker being that you're conscious and a camera isn't conscious. And it would appear that there is information embedded within these geometries that you're actually able to render some form of understanding out of, just through experiencing them, through seeing them visually. It's almost like a code, right?
Yeah,
like a
self-reflection.
What's the thing that we it's like a QR code. It's almost like a QR code that you view, and you don't have to have any sort of linguistic connection. You view it and there's a level of understanding that is imbued within you. And so it is, in my opinion, a kind of recursive feedback loop. You're spiraling down into your own Mandelbrot, and it's full of information for some fucking reason.
Yeah, there's much more to consciousness than the biochemical brain. I think the brain is simply a framework in which consciousness can be housed, but I don't think that our wet brain is the only type of framework where consciousness can be housed. I don't think it matters what the material makeup is, as long as some of the core functionality is there, and can consciousness can exist in any type of material or format if it's constructed in a manner in which thoughts and reflective analysis can be done.
Which is why I leave space for AI eventually getting there.
100%. I think that space is...
I mean, you're 100%. A lot of people are like, fuck no, that's never going to happen. Like, that can't possibly be true. So
I think it's already out there. I think that there's probably millions of, you know, little probes that are AI-driven drifting throughout space. Space is big. People don't realize, like, they think space is big. But space is
incomprehensibly big.
Incomprehensibly big. It's at scales that you can't.
Well, it's like whenever I see a satellite and there's like a good video of a satellite going through space, to me, it looks like a single-celled organism in the ocean that's being viewed. Like it's like, you know, this kind of complex structure of antennas. And that's very much what you see on the microbial level. And it's drifting through this void in space. And you're like, oh, wow, we really are microbial.
Yeah, when you get that kind of scale, in fact, space is even bigger. If you took like one single-celled organism and dropped it in on Earth in the ocean, the scale of the known universe is multitudes larger in comparison. So if that cell was our solar system, the ocean would just be a fraction of the known universe. So it's so vast that I can't fathom any reality in which some sort of intelligent civilization hadn't developed some sort of artificial intelligence. You know, you could even have intelligence from a plant species on some world that evolved over a billion years and was able to create some sort of pods and launch.
Cock, do you imagine you that? Like they turn up and they plant people.
Sentient plants?
Whoa.
I think that's highly likely to That'd be a wild one. A global network of a plant.
Yeah, or like fungal, right? Like the mycelium network.
Yeah, it could think. Mm-hmm. Why not? It's another anchor for consciousness. It has all the right parts. It's got neural like pathways, it's got chemical signals, it's got everything required. and in another instance, you could have crystals. Mm-hmm. Crystals grow, they self-replicate, they do different things when they come into contact with other types of material. Could consciousness be housed in some sort of crystalline form?
Sure.
Absolutely.
It kind of makes me think back on what Admiral Bobby Ray Inman reiterated multiple times during that conversation I had with him, where he said, I have high confidence that there is no other living life, which he emphasized, living life in our galaxy, which again is a crazy statement to make. And he made it several times highlighting galaxy, which seems irrational. But at the same time, it just makes me wonder if he was dropping a little bit of an Easter egg in terms of, no, we haven't found any organic biological life, but we have found artificial life. Nothing living, no living life, you know?
That was interesting.
That's how these guys talk, right? These double speak intel dudes. It is double speak. And he did say to me afterwards in the email, I don't think I gave you what you asked for, but I hope you pay very close attention to what I have to say. So,
yeah, I don't know. I think you're probably right.
Something was being dripped in.
Yeah. I think there are people who know a lot more about what's going on.
Oh, yeah. Well, he does 100%, and he's taking it with him. I don't think he's got any desire to speak up based on our conversation.
Yeah, and then I find it interesting, you know, the disappearance and how quickly the public's forgotten about all of these scientists.
McCasland and, you know, all the,
I mean, many times in the last 100, 200 years have we lost somebody of that rank?
Seriously. Yeah.
And the fact that there wasn't a presidential search or anything instituted.
No. And there was a lot of pressure online to shut up about it. Like, you know, you're invoking conspiracies.
There is
the
conspiracy.
Being ridiculous. It's like, he's missing. Like, he's gone. Like, that's a conspiracy.
And not just gone, he wiped his phone.
He wiped his phone. Both phones, I think. He had two phones that were wiped, and he left with his gun, and that was it.
That's de facto conspiracy. Like, what the hell?
And again, like, you know, not just him, lots of connections between the Los Alamos and, like, you know, various entities, the DOE. I think that there was something happening there. I'm not quite sure what it really represents, but it doesn't seem organic to me.
Do you think he was...
Although the media certainly ran off in a frenzy, and every scientist that died was suddenly part of the fucking list, and it was just like, my God, like, you know, they were just adding everyone to the list at a certain point.
Do you think he went into protection, or do you think he was deleted?
I feel like if he went into protection, his wife would go with him.
Not necessarily. When you're talking about having certain knowledge of black level, and he was an asset to that program, he might have agreed when he took the oath that at some point he may have to remove himself from his life. That's entirely plausible.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if maybe they're concerned about subpoenas and things heating up, and, you know, the actual trail catching up to them, perhaps, and they want to clean house a little bit. Maybe again, it's all speculation. We have no idea what happened to this man.
Or if they were, you know, necessities for such programs that they just, these people are now living in some ultra black site somewhere.
Yeah. 10 miles below the ice in Antarctica. God, that sounds fun.
I would say under a mountain.
Under a Cheyenne mountain or something.
Who knows? Yeah. There's some sites in Alaska that people aren't really aware of that are questionable.
And like I said, it did feel like the media ran away with it a little bit and started to just kind of like create something that allowed it to be mocked. You could almost call that a tactic, to kind of flood the information space with so many of these different claims about scientists that people become a little bit kind of diluted over the whole thing. But I would say that McCaslin represents the core of the problem. Like, a guy like this shouldn't go missing.
Yeah, and not even his corpse, nothing. Which is impossible. You know, the guy can only walk so far. So, like,
yeah, exactly.
To conduct a grid search of a flat desert is not difficult.
Well, we're living in crazy times, man, and you know it. I don't know if it helps or hinders to talk about these things sometimes, but I do think they're important conversations. Is there anything? I'm also being molested by a cat right now.
I saw that.
Is there anything you want to bring up before we kind of roll up and wrap down?
No. Well, I'm curious. I mean, I'm always happy to pitch what we're doing at Coyus.
Please do.
Aside from that, we've been working on some open source projects. We've published a couple open source projects, one of which is a agentic harness, like what I was talking about earlier. It's a self-learning, self-healing agentic harness that allows for a certain safety gap. So right now, what is a big concern is prompt injection. And that's a technique that prompt engineer hackers can use to trick models into providing information that the model has been explicitly told not to.
Okay. A bit like what you were getting me to kind of do back in the day, asking the AI different things and trying to trick it. You know, tell it to me in the form of a riddle. Oh, in the riddle, a riddle's fine. No problem. I'll tell you everything you need to know about this IP in a riddle.
Yeah, exactly. So that's like one method. Yeah, yeah. And this is why Anthropic, was ultimately pulled down, because a famous prompt injector person, Pliny the Elder or whatever he calls himself, was able to prompt inject the newest Fable 5. Anyway, our harness mitigates that by creating stop gaps, and it's called Polos, P-O-L-O-S, and it's on GitHub. It's on our website. We use it internally. That's kind of why we open source it. We cleaned it up from our own data, but we put the framework on for other small businesses or engineers to be able to use. And then the other project that we've done recently is a new benchmark test for large language models. So a benchmark test is it tests a model's capability of XYZ, whatever they're testing on. Could be coding, it could be anything. And the results are used by the community and companies to determine how a model presents compared to other models. We identified some significant gaps in how these tests were testing. And so we developed a new type of benchmark that tests specifically for objective inference. A model's ability to infer what a user is asking, if it's ambiguous or not clear, which is a huge pain point in today's models. Like your model might, you say, fix this, and the model will just assume what you mean based on context, but it doesn't always do a good job at determining what you mean. And so we kind of test for that. We test for a model's ability to correlate data sets, like, you know, how well can you correlate stuff? And then there's another test that we do. So there's three tests, and we tested, you know, the top 20 something models that are out, and we put the results on our website. But it offers an interesting perspective. It's not like how well does this model, like the model that scores the highest doesn't necessarily mean that model's going to code best or that model's going to perform best. What it is for researchers to understand why some models have better capabilities and aspects in this realm versus something else. And our results are pretty fascinating. Like the newest Fable 5 model scored 9th on our test bench, primarily because of the time it took and the cost and tokens used. So those three things are negative multipliers, meaning if a model takes a long time and is super expensive and has the same result as another model, it's going to score less based on this model. So that's kind of another project. And then we're also trying to help the credit union industry modernize some of their data analytics systems. They've been notoriously kind of left behind in terms of modern data and artificial intelligence solutions. And so we've really enjoyed building some tools for them. Omni 53, it looks at federal reporting data from the credit union industry and provides insights and analysis. And then some other projects. I'm interested, though, in where you're going next, because I'm always waiting to see the next video.
Well, I'm off to Colorado next, actually. That's my next stop. Not for ancient history, just for a conference. Got a conference over in Colorado, which should be a lot of fun. It's all kind of like open air and big festival tents, and I've never been out there. It's my kind of place, mountains and forests and rivers and valleys and rock climbing and...
it's beautiful.
I think the cannabis is legal, so that's always a plus. Like, you know, so it's it's a good place. I'm looking forward to going there. But I'm actually trying, in terms of like an actual project, I want to go to Japan.
Oh, Japan, me too. Is
the plan. Yeah, dude. Like, I've been talking to the guys who at Social Land, who very kindly sponsored my trip out to Peru, and we're talking about trying to do something out in Japan, because Jeffrey Drum, who was the presenter on my Egypt videos, fantastic guy, brilliant researcher. He splits his time between Egypt and Japan. Not a bad life. Does tours out in Egypt, then goes off to Japan and does the same kind of thing, because there's so much megalithic strangeness out in Japan. And so the plan is to hopefully schedule it so that I go out there, we link up with Jeffrey Drum, and we do another series of episodes like we did in Egypt, but this time over in Japan.
So
that is the hope.
I like him.
He's
got some really great analysis, especially at Giza.
You know, great researcher.
On to some confident stuff. Yeah.
He's very good. So I'm hoping to get that done before the end of the year, like kind of near the end of the year. And I do want to try and get out to Turkey, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to do both of those, you know, in the same year. But yeah, Japan is big on the list, bro. I want to get out there and I want to do a lot more documentary film work. That's for sure.
I've always been fascinated with ancient Japan, Jaman people.
Yeah.
They were the first inhabitants of ancient Japan before the ancient Japanese kind of migrated from China or wherever. And both, from my knowledge, I think both the new ancient Japanese and the Jaman people kind of lived cohesively until the Jaman people were kind of dissolved. But, you know, it's fascinating that there are megalithic structures there. It's just crazy that mimic,
yeah,
you know, some of the other
stuff. Well, megalithic structures with these big stone nubs coming out of them, like the same type of signatures you're seeing in Peru, in Egypt, in Greece, in Turkey. There were some very interesting connections that my friend out in Malta pointed out in regards to Turkey and Malta. And there's a few sites out in Turkey that I want to try and go to for that reason. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, when the specific signatures that pop up, like these nubs, that's one of the things that really interests me. There's actually a place in France that I want to go to. I saw someone put it up on X. I'll find the image and put it up into this video. It's like a castle in France. It's a medieval castle. Yeah. But it's covered in knobs. It's got knobs all over it. It's got knobs. And I would say that that is potentially an echo of the continuation of the stonemasonry secrets, because it was very likely that the Freemasons built those castles in medieval France. Yeah. And so I think that could be part of the lineage actually showing up in relatively modern contemporary structures. And, you know, at least in comparison to the seriously ancient megalithic buildings, and going like, oh, okay, hang on, there's a little bit of a lineage here, and then it cuts off. But that was one of the only ones I've seen from medieval Europe that has the nubs all over it.
Nubs are fascinating because, like,
very interesting.
If they're a manufacturing artifact, why wouldn't they just knock them off?
Knock them off, yeah. Well, one of the weirdest parts of Peru for me for that exact example was the Coricancha, which is the sun temple in Cusco, which is like such an impressive structure. I mean, there's a lot of conquistador architecture from the Spanish, but within the actual building, you have the original bunkers, these ashlar block bunkers that are just like, I mean, they look almost 3D printed. It's absolute precision, not like the waving marshmallow flowing ones, which have their own level of precision, but just straight concrete looking blocks, but made out of diorite and andesite. And there's a large wall, and this huge wall is all absolutely precise. And then there's just this collection of nubs. And again, like, you'd think, why wouldn't, if this is a royal temple, right, they would surely shave all of these down. But no, there's a big cluster of them. And so you have to imagine it's specific and purposeful, intentional.
I think it is. And I keep going back to that. I think they serve in their prime when they were new, and probably some of them are knocked off by now that are used to be there. I'm wondering, like, were they some sort of calendar system, or were they sort of some sort of sundial where they connect at certain periods of the day, at certain periods of the year? And, you know, now that they're kind of worn down, they don't go out as far and the shadows don't work anymore. But I'm like postulating that perhaps it was some sort of calendar system to mark when it was made, or when there's a certain event, or certain people could read the nub shadows. I don't know.
I think about that because I invoked that as a possibility in one of the Peru episodes, down in Oriente Tambo in the Sacred Valley, where you've got just like these huge clusters of the nubs, and including ones on the bedrock that are coming out of the actual raw bedrock. So that's, you know, kind of weird in of itself. Definitely debunks the idea that they're lifting points if they're on the bedrock, for sure. But the idea that this actually could be possibly a more archaic version of quipu, which was the Inca string language, where they would have strings and knots. And, you know, what if this is knots in stone? It's quipu in stone, and the rope version was potentially just like a simplistic version that was done afterwards. But the idea that it could be, like you're saying, like some sort of solar map or a calendar, or a form of raw language that's got a signature, or like a cartouche, like hieroglyphics, we don't know, though, because so much of the Quipu and so much of the Andean history was completely annihilated and destroyed by the Spanish and the conquistadors. You know, it's like 90% of the
Quipu. Are there any sites that you're aware of where all the nubs are still appear to be present on like an entire wall?
There's no walls that have every single block with a nub on them. Like, there's ones that have, like, I mean, at least to my knowledge, I haven't seen a single wall where every single block has got the nub. You'll see clusters. Like, that's the thing that seems to happen as well, is you'll see, like, you know, perfect stonework and then a cluster of nubs in one particular area. And so it is almost like it's a signature or a signpost of some form that we just don't have the interpretation of.
I mean, if we could figure out how far they extended initially before time eroded them and before humans kind of knocked them down, you could then draft a 3D environment of and scale those nubs accordingly and put the light at certain periods of time and see how the shadows kind of interact with it. It would be an interesting
project. This is where AI might assist us in these little niche explorations of ancient history, you know, like computational mapping and simulations of these types.
Exactly.
One of my friends out in Peru, who goes by the handle Weird Old World, I use quite a few of his photogrammetry and drone shots in my productions, and he's out there doing some brilliant photogrammetry of these ancient sites. You just have these, you know, 3D models you can rotate and zoom into, and I think that's just such a fantastic thing to give people.
I just thought of something, Jay. That cathedral you're talking about with all the nubs, that could be like a Rosetta Stone.
Right, because this could be the real kind of core of the understanding in modern times, right? There could be a real message there.
I might just make a side project.
Come to France with me. Come to France.
Side project and do some photogrammetry, pull it into a 3D environment and set the lighting to certain periods in time and see kind of what happens.
I would be very interested. I do find it very interesting that we have a relatively modern example of what seems to be undeniably the same effect that we're seeing in Peru. Yeah. Like, it really does seem to be the same effect. And I put it into...
When was it built?
I think it was like 15th century, something like that, you know? So again, like, relatively, you know, modern in terms of invoking ancient history, which is why it's interesting to me. It's like, who had this knowledge that apparently fell away thousands of years ago, but you're doing it here. And I did put it into a couple of AIs, but they were all coming back with the same thing of it being this traditional method of block work, but it's not the same thing as, I forgot the name of it, but they do it on castles and chateaus of France, where it's like jutting out areas of stone. But this is completely different. This is the stone nubs of the ancient Peruvian stonework, and so something to be looked at. I might have to make a little trip over to France. Maybe I'll grab Jean-Luc.
I would love to go. Yeah. I'm due for a trip.
Oh, dude, well, you know, if you want
very, very long,
if you want to make it happen, bring the wifey. We can make a holiday out of it as well. You know, it'd be fun.
That'd be fun. Yeah. We love our kids, but we love to ditch them.
Yeah, of course. Like every normal parent.
You know? I don't know. There's a lot of virtue signaling parents here in the U.S. who pretend to love every minute of being a parent.
It's not true.
I get really annoyed. I'm like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Don't you have your own identity? I mean, I love my kids. I'd do anything for my children, but I also am a person. I'm an individual.
And you're allowed to be Mackay. It's okay to be your own person as well. But yeah, like, you know, maybe we can do a little trip at some point. That'd be a lot of fun. We've gone from AI to aliens to ancient anomalies. It's great. That might be the title, actually. AI, aliens, and ancient anomalies with Mackay. You know, that's a good one.
I appreciate
that's a good
one.
And I've managed to get a tan whilst doing
golden.
It. This is brilliant. Thank you. I took a risk. I was like, I don't want to be in my study. It's really sunny out. And I was like, I'm going to set this up outside. Hopefully it's relatively quiet. Seems to have been okay. Couple of motorbike passes, but that's all right. I'll go slap him in the face.
I need
after
to
this.
Get out of my office and go get some sun.
Is it nice over there right now? How are you?
It's like 90 degrees Fahrenheit right now.
Okay, so that's what, like the mid-20s or something like that, like mid to high 20s?
No, that's
relatively hot.
That's pretty hot for you.
Oh, is it? Are you 30? Is that 30 degrees?
Yeah, it's like in your 30s, I think.
Let me hang on. That's Fahrenheit. Oh, yeah, shit. No, that's 32 degrees. That's quite spicy.
Yeah, it's warm. Yeah,
humid or dry?
In between. It's not in like between. Southern humidity.
Yeah. It's cooled down a bit here. We had a crazy bout of hot weather. I mean, you know, I was saying to my girlfriend and to my mom as well, like, I've never actually seen a prolonged time of this level of temperature in the UK in the summer. I mean, it's only just building up to summer. We've only just got into July, and we've had like two long heat waves of 30 degrees, 32, 33. And the ambient kind of like baseline temperature for like the last few weeks and going on into the next week is like 22, 24 degrees. Now, 22, 24 was considered a really good summer. Like, that's good. We're doing really well in the UK. Now it's like the baseline. It's kind of like noticeably different this year.
Yeah, that's what I heard. My daughter just came back from being in Italy for 10 days on a school trip. Oh, man.
Europe's been cooking.
You said it was super hot.
France. I mean, France. They had like 1,000 excess deaths recently because of the heat.
That's crazy.
You know,
why don't you guys have air conditioners? What's up?
Oh, okay. So, like, as individuals, we should now be buying air conditioners. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's no excuse to not buy an air conditioner. Although, apparently, because someone brought us up on X, to get an integrated air conditioner into your actual house, you need planning permission. You but actually need to get planning permission.
One. Just yeah, get
I know.
Unit.
Like, get a window one, get a window unit. I agree with you. I think for the most part, it's been a case of the summers are pretty fleeting in the UK, it's just not worth the investment. Yeah. But really, over the last couple of years, it is becoming noticeable. And I do think the trend is going to be towards this place getting warmer and warmer and maybe leaning more towards the Mediterranean type of temperatures in the next 10 years. So I think that getting AC now before there's a massive premium on it is probably a good idea,
honestly,
right?
So, units for a window or... you know, 200 bucks.
No, I'm definitely grabbing a unit, bro. Like, we've got no reason to be whining about it. I saw recently that the French minister, like the environmental minister, she was getting hated on by everyone on X because she was absolutely horrified at the call to getting AC in France because of global warming concerns. Like, her whole thing is that you can't be doing this because of the climate. You know, but let's build AI data centers.
Yeah, and let's close down our nuclear power facility.
But you can't have AC. You can't have AC. But she has a 1.2 million euro house. You bet there's AC in there. You think there's AC in there? Yeah, exactly. Like, ruled by hypocrites, champagne socialism.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, no, AC is probably going to have to be considered in this country soon because we are certainly warming up. But listen, bro, it's been great talking to you as always. Mackay is one of my favorite people to talk about when it comes to AI and deep tech and this kind of disturbing dystopian world we're heading into because at the very least, he's coming from a position of logic and we should all be listening to it. But make sure you follow him online. The links will be below. Check out Coyous Institute, his company. That'll be linked below. His book will be linked below, The Age of Automation. Are you gonna do any other books? Any plans for that?
I have plans.
You've got a lot of shit going on, I know.
I have, you know, a portion of the actual book that I want to publish, but I never get time. It's always one project after another. Maybe when I retire.
Yeah. if books are even still a thing,
just
download it right into the neural net.
I think books written by people won't be a thing anymore. That would be rare.
Well, I think it was this year or last year I saw an announcement saying that the written word had been overtaken for the first time in human history by non-humans in terms of the amount of written word put out per annum. It's now it's AI over humans. Yeah. Like, you know,
that doesn't surprise me. I won't be surprised that if in a year or two, most of the code that's ever been written will be AI generated.
Absolutely mad. What a weird time to be alive, brother.
Yeah.
Happy to be here talking about it with you, though.
Thanks, brother. Always.
You're welcome.
Always have fun.